Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I think there's this is one of the few times where I've had a case down here where I'm not entirely sure what the most interesting part of this court is going to be, so I'm just going to start on my outline and go from there. I think one of the big issues that we've been arguing about with the state has been this jointly drafted issue on the jury instructions. I think my brief pretty much speaks to the argument as to whether or not this instruction 14 was jointly drafted or not, and I don't know that I have a lot more that I can add to point one on the jointly drafted part, but I think one of the key issues...
What does jointly drafted mean? If it was initially drafted by the state, but then you both talk to the judge and talk about changes to the instruction together, does that make it jointly drafted, or does it still remain drafted by the state?
Well, I think it still remains drafted by the state. As I said in the brief, if the state goes downstairs and drafts an instruction and then the state writes, "I drafted this," and then gives it to the judge, then that should sort of be the end of the inquiry there, that this could possibly be jointly drafted. I think the state is arguing that by suggesting a couple of edits to the jury instruction, it then becomes jointly drafted, and then that waives any argument about errors in that particular instruction. But even looking to the record, it sort of highlights the fact that this was drafted by the state. Counsel for the defendant was in the courtroom talking about other jury instructions while this was being drafted downstairs by Ms. Lundak. And I think looking...
Did you tender appropriate instruction, or what you think was one that was rejected?
The instruction submitted by Clay's trial attorney did contain the same error that I was...
So why doesn't that demonstrate that you failed to preserve an instructional error when you submit an instruction that has the same error that you're complaining about?
I'm arguing that not necessarily. I think when you say preserved, at least to me, that thinks of it was preserved in the trial court as an error that can be reviewed as abuse of discretion as opposed to plain error. And what we're arguing is that this is a plain error review because it wasn't, because Clay's attorney didn't draw the trial court's attention to this.
And the difference is whether it's plain error or whether it's waived.
Yes, and not whether it's abuse of discretion or the standard that would be used for a preserved made objection to the trial court about a jury instruction.
So why is it plain error?
It's plain error because instruction 14 requires that whenever it's injected, based upon there being any evidence of withdrawal, then you must give the withdrawal portion of the self-defense instruction. And it becomes particularly prejudicial here for two reasons, because, first of all, the way the instruction is written...
The standard for plain error isn't prejudicial, it's manifest injustice, correct?
Prejudicial... Well, the prejudice results in a manifest injustice, and here the manifest injustice is the fact that the way the instruction was submitted, looking at the video and the testimony that was elicited, there was a withdrawal. And instead, the argument is just he's the initial aggressor because he went outside. He can never stop being the initial aggressor. As I said in the reply brief, it might be a bit hyperbolic, but the way the instruction is written, Joel White could have come back later in the morning with a shotgun, and Larry Clay still can't defend himself.
What about the first part of the plain error analysis, that the error has to be open, obvious, and clear? How do you overcome that both lawyers didn't think it was open and obvious and clear?
Well, to me it's open and obvious because you can't look at Missouri-approved instruction, I think it's 306.06A, read the notes on use, that you have to do this. Why the attorneys didn't do it, I can't say for sure, but... If it's written in the Missouri approved instructions that you have to do this and it wasn't done, to me that seems to be the most...
Well, and I guess you're arguing if the fact that no one objected meant it wasn't open and obvious and clear, then there would never be plain error, and yet cases have found plain error in the case of these kinds of instructional errors.
Yeah, you know, and I think, yeah, if the standard is somebody had to object to it for it to be plain error, well, then it wouldn't be plain error anymore.
Well, isn't the standard, it's something that's supposed to be so open and obvious that the trial court objects itself and interjects itself and gives an appropriate instruction? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really what we're looking at, whether the trial court should have noticed this by itself and instructed differently than the parties suggested.
Well, the Missouri improved jury instructions, I mean, the books make it clear that there's three people or three entities that are responsible for properly instructing a jury, and that includes the trial court. And we're here on direct appeal, so it's a trial court error in not properly instructing based on this plain error. I think certainly at some point in the future, as the Western District noted in a footnote, there might be a post-conviction relief that would come down the line later.
Did the comment say that you should give a withdrawal instruction if it was injected into the case?
The notes on use say that once it's in, if there's evidence, you know, I obviously didn't, no, I don't have it right in front of me, but so I don't want to paraphrase, but the notes on use do say that once this matter is injected, it's supposed to be, you're supposed to use the paragraph regarding withdrawal.
And does that make it open and obvious?
To me, it makes it open and obvious when there's basically a guidebook on what you're supposed to do with the jury instructions, and for some reason, it's not followed. And I think this sort of also ties into a lot of times the argument then becomes, well, maybe this was some type of a strategy, and I think that relates to point one and point six. And for example, I went over and I've got murder in first degree MAI from next door. And I think there's a huge difference in trial strategy between taking a jury instruction, picking a paragraph that's supposed to be given, and just drawing lines through it. Defendant knew or was aware that his conduct was causing or practically certain to cause death. Let's cross that out. What's my trial strategy for just crossing out a part that the state has to prove, as opposed to what I think the state is trying to argue is the trial strategy of whether or not you submit a lesser offense. Just crossing out parts of a jury instruction is not trial strategy, because the only thing, every benefit is to the defendant based on the fact that the state has to prove each of these three or four things that are in the jury instruction. And me, as a trial attorney, randomly crossing that out, all I'm doing is making it easier for my client to be convicted, as opposed to the trial strategy of I'm going to make the state prove murder one, and if they can't prove murder one, I'm not going to let them fall back and prove murder two or involuntary manslaughter. And so that's one of the things, I guess, that the state puts forward as to there being a trial strategy, but there is no trial strategy in just tampering with the jury instructions.
Counsel, the state argues that after the proposed self-defense instruction had been revised in various ways by both parties, the counsel for the defendant, Mr. Clay, stated, quote, looks good. Mm-hmm. Why isn't it proper? I mean, isn't that an inference that the defense counsel acquiesced to that instruction?
Well, I do agree with you, and I was pleasantly surprised to find that there were three cases from this court that say, one of them seems to say that saying, yeah, it looks good, not objecting to a bad instruction doesn't waive that error, it still is only plain error. Submitting the same bad instruction as long as it wasn't used keeps it plain error, and then not submitting correct instructions just makes it plain error. And I think that's the, you know, if you want to say a punishment of sort to my client for not correctly submitting the instruction, is that it's plain error. And so the saying looks good keeps it in, is, it's within prior holdings of this court that still doesn't waive the error. And I think also related to that, if this court is going to hold that by talking with the other side about what's wrong with an instruction then makes it jointly drafted and then waives any possible errors in it, then at that point, I as a Missouri criminal defense trial attorney am per se committing malpractice by even talking to the state about the jury instructions.
Well, couldn't you just discuss with them and try to negotiate what you think is accurate, and at the end of the day, just offer a correct instruction? You'd be certain that your error was preserved then.
Well, but I think in cases such as this, where the that since nobody brought it up, it seemed that nobody had this error in their mind. And so me, if I'm a criminal defense attorney, maybe if I'm trying to be careful, maybe there's something I'm missing when I'm submitting these instructions, and I don't want to waive that. So I can't talk to the state. I can't say okay to anything. I can't try to correct any of their instructions that I think might be erroneous, because then down the line I'm going to have waived something I missed and materially disadvantaged my client. And I think even then further, so if that's jointly drafted, that instruction, then is the next step that because we jointly drafted this instruction, do we then argue, well, you jointly drafted this instruction, so you actually jointly drafted the whole packet that was submitted to the court. And so then now, have I waived every error to every instruction that might be hidden that I don't know about? I've done civil cases where the other side has sort of dug in their heels that they're not going to deal with me in any way on instructions, and everything grinds to a halt. There is no progress forward. And so I don't think that's what this court wants jury instruction conferences to be. And I think instead, if the state's submitting an instruction or if the defendant's submitting an obstruction, they'll say that on the instruction. And if we've jointly drafted it, we'll write that we jointly drafted it, or we're submitting instruction 16 by stipulation. And then that's what the court, and that's what the instruction will be, or that would waive.
What isn't the better course to consider that as one piece of evidence that we look at as to whether it was jointly submitted? That doesn't bind the court or bind anyone, but that obviously is evidence that weighs on one side of that question.
Well, I think I think somebody writing that they drafted something on it and submitting it to the court should be pretty binding. I've been down, I've been to the Court of Appeals on cases where, the criminal defendant said he understood something, he didn't have any problems with his trial attorney, and then he's bound by the record of saying, I understood this, and so he can't withdraw his plea now. So at this point, the state should be bound by the fact that they went downstairs and wrote, I did this.
Your time is up. Okay. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court. As to the first point on whether the instruction was jointly drafted, there are about 12 to 15 pages of discussion about how this instruction was going to be drafted. And they started off by working from the defense version of the instruction, because the defense was the party who wanted the initial aggressor language to be put in. Then they moved back, after discussing some changes, they moved back to working from the state's draft.
And did they lose the defendant's instructions at some point?
I don't know if they lost them. At one point, I think the trial court mentioned that it misplaced a version of the instruction. But at some point, the trial court said, okay, I'm back to working from the state's version, because they had discussed and agreed on modifications that would be made to the instruction at the defense request. And finally, at the end, right before the assistant prosecutor leaves to go and make the changes, defense counsel says, so you guys have the modifications on those then? And they say, yeah, we've got those. We're going to go down. I need to take that down there with me to make the changes.
And opposing counsel says at that point, when you rewrote it with changes, you wrote submitted by plaintiff.
Yeah, and that's on the face of the instruction, in fact.
And so what is the effect of that, that it was submitted by the prosecution?
I think the prosecutor was just following their normal practice of what they do in any case when they write up an instruction, and they put submitted by plaintiff on there. Now, I think our rules indicate, 2802 says that should be indicated on the face of the instruction who submitted the instruction. I think that's done for purposes of record and making sure the record's clear. But and in many instances, that's
You understand the point. It didn't say jointly submitted. How much weight should we give to that? Opposing counsel says it's dispositive. You think it has any weight, or how do we balance this out?
I think it has very little weight in light of the rest of the record in this case, which shows a collaborative effort by the parties to make changes that the defense requested.
Can you address the policy arguments raised by Mr. Gillette, that if we did that, you'd encourage defense counsel? Basically, they wouldn't be able to talk about what change to be made without endorsing the instruction, and that's not to the benefit of their client.
No, I don't think that I'm advocating anything like that. I'm saying that when parties specifically agree to and say, we want this language, then a claim of error with regard to that language is waived. Now, if there are other issues that the defendant wants to preserve and say, I don't agree to that. For instance, when they got to Part C on the instruction, there was a question about which of the two threats paragraphs should be submitted. One talking about evidence of threats made by defendant against victim and threats by victim against defendant, and one which said simply if there were threats by the victim, then that can be considered.
But no one talked about whether the withdrawal language should be in the instruction, did they?
Correct.
So this isn't a case where they talked about it and they said, we don't want this or we do want this, which would be different.
That's right. Yeah. My point is, though, that to preserve the error, you should talk about it. And, you know, if they had wanted to preserve an error as to...
Then what's plain error?
Well, in some instances, you'll have plain error where... the trial court, and I guess the plain error would arise in a situation not where it's not waived. If it's waived, I mean, there might be an error, you know, and there might even be a plain error, but it can be waived, and that's what waiver is all about, is actually acknowledging.
Why would silence be waiver as opposed to plain error?
Well, I don't think this is necessarily silence as much as it is a collaboration by both parties saying, we agree that this is the language that we want. Now, as to why they were silent in this case about that, and whether this is an evident error, moving beyond waiver. I mean, I think our positions are pretty straightforward in terms of whether we think it was jointly drafted or not. But whether it was plain error in this instance, and why they weren't talking about it, I think is probably twofold. On the part of the state, they probably didn't perceive evidence of a withdrawal, and so thus didn't believe that the language should be included, and that's the argument we continue to make on appeal. On the part of the defense, the defense theory was always, throughout the case, that the defendant was not the initial aggressor, ever. And it's only when the defendant was the initial aggressor that you would even need the withdrawal language.
Could we focus on that? Because your brief, the requirement to submit the withdrawal paragraph is if the defendant injects the issue.
Yes.
Your brief argues that there has to be substantial evidence that Mr. Clay withdrew, which substantial evidence seems to be very different than evidence that injects the issue.
Well, substantial evidence is a term that the court has employed when talking about self-defense. And the standard for submitting self-defense is the same under the statute, that the issue is injected into the case. And so the phrase substantial language is merely a term or a phrase that's been employed by the court to describe the quantum of evidence that needs to be present to raise the issue so as to place the burden on the state to disprove it. And I believe that that issue is currently before the court in the Bruner case, which was argued a little while back on the self-defense issue, and what quantum of evidence is necessary. And I guess that, you know, in its minimal formulation, there needs to be some evidence, which has sometimes been called substantial evidence. And what it would require in this case is evidence of a withdrawal that was effectively communicated to the other party.
I mean, it doesn't have to be. Injecting it is a more minimal term than showing by preponderance of the evidence or some other terms they could use. You have to have made it an issue in some way.
Yeah,
is there any guidance in the case law previously as to what that means and how it relates to substantial evidence?
There's guidance in the statute about what injecting the evidence means. It doesn't really refer to a quantum of evidence as much as it refers to who bears the burden of proof mm-hmm. on an issue that's injected. And when an issue is injected, the state bears the burden of proof on that issue. So the state, in this instance, would have to disprove that he acted in lawful self-defense. And with its various parts, if there was initial aggressor or withdrawal or those sorts of things. So injecting the issue by statute refers to more to the burden or who carries the burden, not necessarily the quantum of evidence that has to be in a case. But again, I think that there has to be some evidence, which again has sometimes been called substantial evidence. And in this case, I don't think there was any evidence.
But has it in that context been called substantial evidence? In the context of injecting, or
I don't think by this court. In fact, I don't think I found a case by this court which talked about the level of evidence that's required on a withdrawal, or even a case discussing that particular concept. if I'm remembering correctly, I think the cases I found were Court of Appeals cases. The statutory language is there has to be evidence of withdrawal that's effectively communicated to the other participant. The MAI, if it were to be included in the MAI, the communication has to be clearly indicated to the other side. And in this case in particular, I don't think there was any evidence of a communication by Mr. Clay, Mr. White, that he was withdrawing from the encounter.
His evidence indicated that he believed he was withdrawing. Is that correct? So you do have evidence from him that he walked away with the gun down, turned his back to the to Mr. White.
Well, I don't think he ever said he was withdrawing. He testified at trial and never said that he was withdrawing. He did say that he wanted him off his property. He did say he backed him down the driveway, and he did turn, and he said that Mr. White immediately came up behind him again. But I don't know that he ever said that he either withdrew or communicated that withdrawal to Mr. White. Now,
do you believe the characterization of the evidence in the appellant's brief is inaccurate then?
I believe it's inaccurate to the extent that he says he was pointing his gun at him and that he then lowered his gun and turned and walked away. I think the video shows a continuous conflict where you have the three main players sort of moving around.
The video is one piece of evidence, but Mr. Clay's testimony is a different piece. So what did he say in his testimony?
Mr. Clay testified that he backed him off of the property and that he then turned, and Mr. White immediately came up on him again, and he turned back. There didn't seem to be any real break, according to his testimony. Now, according to the video, there was a break of at least a second or two, because he walked back up the driveway.
And again, that's different evidence.
Sure.
that may be contrary to Mr. Clay's testimony.
I'm not sure that it's even contrary. I think that Mr. Clay's testimony was given in a manner that's largely consistent with the video, which is silent.
But the evidence was that he turned and walked toward the house, and then the victim went after him.
The victim, went after him, I think, is a characterization that may not be supported by the video, because he walks very slowly back onto the driveway.
Again, we don't look at contrary evidence. We just look at the evidence favorable to the submission.
And Mr. Clay testified that he came back up on him from behind. Which
and I think the only at least my only question is that enough to inject that issue?
Perhaps. I think viewed generously, it might be enough to inject the idea that he withdrew, took a step back from the conflict, mm-hmm. but there wasn't any evidence that he communicated that effectively to Mr. White. And withdrawal has two
points. There's two issues here. One is this omission of the withdrawal language. The other is, which may have been inadvertent or not, then there's the clearly intentional decision to seek a separate instruction on duty to retreat.
Yes.
Is there some overlap there? Is this all one strategic decision, or are these really two unrelated issues?
Well, I wouldn't say that there was overlap on the strategy on defense counsel's part, because defense counsel actively requested the no duty to retreat instruction, whereas there wasn't any request for the withdrawal language. And I think it's pretty evident why they wouldn't request the withdrawal language, because they never argued or even suggested in any fashion that Mr. Clay was the initial aggressor who then needed to withdraw so that he could use force. But on the issue of no duty to retreat, there was a request by defense counsel to submit a separate non-MAI instruction, which was refused in part because it wasn't authorized by MAI. And the case law indicates, and I guess that would be, I think, a question the court needs to resolve is whether, first of all, I think for the reasons outlined in the state's brief, rejecting a separate instruction on that was proper. The applicable instruction would be the self-defense instruction, which should include all the applicable principles relevant to self-defense. And so the trial court was correct to reject the separate instruction. But the next question that's raised is whether the trial court should have sua sponte taken upon itself to say, well, let's go back to the instruction. Let's revisit the self-defense instruction that the parties have submitted to the court and make a modification to that. And the argument is that it was plain error for the trial court here not to do that, sua sponte.
Because the notes on use made it the responsibility of the court to do that, whether requested or not.
Yeah, I think the court has a general responsibility to instruct the jury on self-defense, whether requested or not. So, for instance, if nobody came to the court in this case and said, we want self-defense, I think the court would have to say, hey, I'm going to give a self-defense instruction. Now, I personally think that if the parties were to stipulate and to say to the court, we want to remove the issue of self-defense from the jury, the defendant's going to waive his fact-finding on that because we don't want self-defense.
But that didn't happen here.
It did not. No, I'm just speaking hypothetically. But otherwise, if nobody had requested it, the court would have an affirmative duty to submit self-defense because it having been injected, it should have been done. So arguably, there was an error by the court not modifying the instruction. The question I think that the court has to address initially is whether the holding in Bolden reaches to waive that particular error as well, because the claim on appeal is that the trial court should have sua sponte gone back and reviewed the instruction the parties had said, this is what we want, this looks good, and changed it. Now, Bolden suggests that the trial court will not be found to have plainly erred in circumstances where an instruction is jointly submitted because those claims are waived. It was at the error was committed at the instance of the defendant and obviously the state if it's jointly collaborated, and those are waived.
So that argument depends on whether we find it was jointly submitted.
It would. The waiver argument certainly would. And then additionally, whether Bolden reaches out to that situation where not only did they jointly submit it, but later the defense asks for something that implicates what's in that instruction.
Can you address whether there was a synergistic prejudicial effect of failing to give the withdrawal and failing to give the retreat language?
I think that the two are, I wouldn't think so. I mean, I guess I'd need to think about that a little bit. If he hasn't, because the duty to retreat and whether somebody's an initial aggressor, I think, are separate questions. If he has a duty, if he doesn't have a duty to retreat, does that affect whether he has to withdraw? There's some language in the withdrawal cases that says a mere retreat isn't enough to indicate a withdrawal. And I think that's all we have in this case is a few steps back, which I'm not sure I would call a retreat, but
does the failure to instruct on retreat address whether or not, is that relevant to whether or not he was an initial aggressor and going outside and following them outside?
Well, it's certainly something that that the defense argued at trial, that and I see my time's running down, but if I could answer the question, the defense argued at trial that the state was suggesting that it was illegal for him to go outside, and that wasn't what the state argued. The state argued, of course, that he was the initial aggressor because he went outside with the gun and made a but-for factual argument that the shooting wouldn't have occurred if he hadn't gone outside, which is not the same as arguing that he legally could not go outside or that he had a duty to retreat. Nobody ever said he had a duty to retreat. So on the question of whether there's plain error as to duty to retreat, because arguably the trial court, if Bolden doesn't result in a waiver, then arguably the trial court erred. And the question is whether there was manifest injustice from the failure to include at some point in the self-defense instruction. And I looked at it. If you look at 306.11, which talks about a duty to retreat under different circumstances that were not posited here, you can see where it would go and you can see what the language would generally say, and it would probably be something along the lines of, I wrote it down.
I apologize, I'm exceeding my time here, but
it would probably be the fifth paragraph in instruction 14, and it would say something along the lines of, a person does not have a duty to retreat from private property that is owned or leased by such individual before resorting to the use of force to defend himself. Now,
your time is up. Is
yes.
That in your brief?
No, because I didn't see anywhere where it was suggested by the appellant that this language should have been put into the instruction. So I tried to imagine where that might be, and so looked at the instruction. And I guess the question then for the court would simply be, does the omission of that language, which nobody really disputed, lead to a different result in this case? Is it outcome determinative? Thank you.
Thank you.
So I think the first issue would be that I think deciding whether or not these instructions should have been given just as a legal matter, the evidence that is before the court, whether it was injected, under, I believe it's Avery in January or two cases, stating that it should be viewed, the evidence should be viewed in the light most favorable to giving the different instructions. And so I think that when looking at the testimony of Larry Clay and the other witnesses and the video, there's enough there to say that at least the withdrawal was injected. And I don't know what the state, does the state want people to say, pursuant to 531.016, I am withdrawing from this conflict and going inside, and that's what I have to say to withdraw from a conflict? Or does turning around and walking inside after saying, wait here and Mr. Becklin will pick you up, is that sufficient to inject the particular issue of a withdrawal?
Can you address the failure to allow you to argue the retreat issue and the law on retreat?
So I think that that is definitely being expanded as well. I think we talked about the amendment of the statute and how it's sort of indicating an intent in Missouri to not put on people that are being attacked the duty to figure out exactly what they need to do to escape without resorting to physical harm. And by not permitting to even argue the issue of the duty of retreat, as I've said in my brief, it's manifestly unjust and prejudicial on its own, but then it combines with the state was able to argue, Larry Clay, you are the initial aggressor because you went outside. Then they're able to argue, you don't get to argue that you get to retreat. Then they get to argue, once you're the initial aggressor, you can never not be the initial aggressor.
The state characterized its argument as not arguing that legally Mr. Clay had a duty to retreat. Do you agree with that or disagree?
I disagree with that. I've got three quotes that I handwrote here. He was the initial aggressor as soon as he went outside. He could have prevented this, but he didn't. If you don't go outside, White lives. These are all arguing that if he doesn't do something that he has a 100% right to do.
Arguing he had a 100% right to go outside with a gun.
Yes.
And so the only issue as to whether he's the initial aggressor is how he behaved when he went outside with the gun.
Yes. And I think in addition to that, the state has also argued that, and if I could just finish, that this actually was one giant brawl that went on for the whole night and started in the basement, and then it's outside, and then it ends when somebody gets shot. I mean, even the state then is arguing, and we have a jury verdict that Larry Clay wasn't the initial aggressor at the fight that started in the basement, which the state is arguing the whole thing was just a big fight that lasted for, 30 minutes or something. And so he did have the right to go outside. He did have the right to defend himself, and as such, he...
Thank you. Case will be submitted.